Some things never change. An exposition of Genesis chapter 10 verses 8 through 11 and chapter 11 verses 1 through 9. This message by Pastor Rod Harris was delivered at Trinity Baptist Church on Wednesday evening, August the 8th, 2012.
I look back on it now and I laugh about it. I wasn't laughing at all then because I was just mad. And I remember looking at my brother and saying, I'm going to teach you a lesson. I'm going to clean your clock. And so I lit into him. Now the problem was, he's 5 years older than me and a whole lot taller. And I was about 8. And so he stood with his hand on my head and just held me at arm's length while I wore myself out. And I never laid a finger on him. I swung with all my might and I kicked and I yelled and I screamed until I just collapsed. And the whole time he stood there and laughed. And I looked back at it now and said, that had to be a funny sight. I mean, he was about 6 foot at the time, and here this little round kid with the short arms isn't going anywhere near him. That's really funny, but it's not near as funny as the thought of a man who stands and shakes his fist in the face of God and dares to defy him. That's why the psalmist says, when the kings of the earth conspire and the people plot in vain, when the kings of the earth take their stand, the one enthroned in heaven laughs and the Lord scoffs at them. The plots of men and rulers are no great threat to God and His sovereignty. His throne is in no danger of toppling. At best, they're a minor nuisance. They're no threat to His kingly reign. They're no threat to His person. Reading the opening chapters of Genesis, I read that God is sorry that He ever made man. And when I read that, I say, yeah, I can understand that. And then I read that He decided that He was going to destroy all living things. And I said, now that I can understand, given what's happened to His beautiful creation. What's hard to understand, what I have difficulty with, is not God's judgment, not His wrath, but His mercy and His kindness. It's harder to understand, if you take the biblical view, why Noah found favor in the sight of God. Again, it's not because Noah was such a great and wonderful person. It isn't that God looked down and said, now of all the people on the earth, Noah is a great righteous man. Noah was no different than the others, but God chose to favor him. God was merciful to him, and God spared Noah and his family. How do I know Noah was no different? Because of the subsequent sin that fell on Noah after his great stand. God was merciful. God chose to be loving and kind. Following the flood, Noah committed great evil. He got drunk and passed out, and we read that and we say, now how could this good and righteous man do that? But we need to understand he was a man of faults and failures, a man who was preserved by God's grace. But following the flood, God determined that He would never destroy mankind in the same way. Why? Was it because man learned his lesson? No. Was it because, well, God brought that great judgment and everybody changed? Everybody acted differently? No, that's not why. Because they didn't. Nothing was really different. By grace, God chose to love sinful and wicked folks. Because that has always been the program of God. That God would justify the wicked. Man didn't change as a result of the fall. Man, in his natural state, is still hostile to God and His whole plan and program. And that's evidenced by the greatest example of wickedness in the human heart, revealed as part of the story of the Tower of Babel, which is our text in Genesis chapter 11. Genesis chapter 11, we're going to look at verse 1 down through verse 9. We're coming to the close of the first major section in the book of Genesis, that section that is often referred to as biblical mythology. Because there are those, even within the church, who say this is not intended as historical. That the first 11 chapters of Genesis were not intended to be and should not be read as literal historical events. Rather, they're allegories or fables or myths that are told for a purpose. It's there to tell us something about God's character and nature, but these things didn't really happen, and it's wrong to interpret them or read them in that way. Now, the technical term for that school of thought is baloney. There is nothing in the biblical text that says, now here's a story. There's nothing here like when Jesus tells a parable and the biblical writer says, now Jesus told them a parable. There's nothing in the text to say this is to be understood in any way other than literal historical narrative. That this is what took place. Adam and Eve were two literal historical people who were placed in a literal garden, and through the temptation of the evil one, they rebelled. Adam sinned with his eyes opened and knowingly rebelled against the commands of God, and death and sin then entered the picture. God brought a curse, and yet at the same time he was gracious, and in the time that he gave the curse and brought judgment, he also spoke of their ultimate deliverance. The seed of the woman who would have his heel bruised, but he would crush the head of the serpent. So in Genesis 3, we hear that horrific account of what happened to God's good and beautiful creation and God's righteous judgment on that sin and that act of rebellion. There is also the promise of deliverance, all because of God's mercy. Just when you think things got back on track, we have the first homicide. Cain killed his brother Abel. Again, in rebellion against God. He was upset because his brother's sacrifice was acceptable when his was not. Then we read about the godly line being established with Seth. And just when you think they're finally on their way, then God is sorry that he ever made man. And so the worldwide flood. As we come to these chapters, we're at that point where the human family has an opportunity to begin again. They have an opportunity to start all over. But it doesn't take long before corruption reigns again. In chapter 10, we have the table of nations. Here are the descendants of Noah, and here's how that played out. Now, you may be asking, okay, you were doing a good job of there walking through those passages, one right after the other, and you come to this, and you skip over chapter 10 and go to chapter 11. Why? Well, look at chapter 10. Look at those names. Of course I skipped over. I skipped over because what I want to show you is things never change. Some things never change. The heart of man did not change after the flood. Now, I will back up into chapter 10 just for a couple of verses. I want you to look at verse 8. Cush fathered Nimrod. He was the first of the earth to be a mighty man. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord, therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calneh, and the land of Shinar. So here we have the Nimrod, the first of the dictators, the first of the mighty men who established himself as a hunter before the Lord. Now, this table of nations is interesting when you read it. And you go through it, you find out that God's telling us about what happened to the human family and so forth. I remember years ago hearing Adrian Rogers speaking at a conference, and he was talking about when he first went to Bellevue Baptist in Memphis. R.G. Lee had been there for years before he went there. And it was one of those great old churches in the old South, and who you were and your family connections, all that was important. And Dr. Rogers says he hadn't been there very long at all when one of the blue-haired old ladies in the church came up to him and said, after a service, Dr. Rogers, who are your family? And he knew what she meant. You know, who are your people? Where do you come from? Because after all, you're pastor of this great, historic, important church in our town. We didn't even know who your people are. And so he answered her, well, we trace my family back to a drunken sailor and a crooked farmer. The sailor's name was Noah, and the farmer's name was Adam. His point was, you trace us back, we're all the same. It doesn't make any difference. This is who we are. This is where we come from. And you read in chapter 10 and you find out that the Japhethites became the Indo-European people settling the northern regions. The Hamites settled in Arabia, Egypt, Africa, the Orient. The descendants of Shem then settled in the regions of the Promised Land in Asia Minor. The interesting thing is the accuracy of Genesis chapter 10. It wasn't until the 19th century that man had any systematic scientific proof of the connection between the people of India and Europe. But Moses wrote about it 1,200 years before Christ. It's accurate in telling, but the purpose of flying over is to understand the story as it continues, and it reveals the wickedness of the heart of man. Again, we're told of Nimrod, who was a mighty hunter, an important, influential figure. But what I want us to see in chapter 11 is the Tower of Babel reveals the foolishness of man in attempting to live in defiance of God. That's what we need to see. And so soon after the flood, I mean, we're just now getting on with the story. We're just now picking up where what should have happened. You would think that God would bring this devastating judgment. This family is spared and delivered, and you would think about the gratitude and how long they should live in gratitude. It doesn't take very long at all till we're right back as business as usual, and it reveals the foolishness, the emptiness, the perversion of the human heart. Again, Nimrod's the world's first dictator. He was a mighty hunter. That's not because he liked to hunt game. It's because he liked to hunt human beings. He had a grab for power, and he became the builder of cities. And he did so in defiance of God. Nimrod built cities because he was interested in making a name for himself. Now, it may be that Nimrod's response was, my family cursed? I don't think so. My family going to be the servant of others? I don't think so. In order to prove it, I will enslave others. He was in defiant of what God had decreed. Three things I want us to see as we work through these nine verses. First, in 1 through 4, just the arrogance of man as it's revealed in the text. Now, the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they settled there. They said to one another, come, let us make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had bricks for stone and bit them for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. The first two verses set the context for what happened. Of course they all spoke the same language. Of course they all had the same words. They're all descended from the same family. Verses 3 and 4 tell us about their plan. Their plan calls for three things. Number one, they're going to build a city. Number two, they have a desire to build a reputation for themselves. And number three, their plan is to establish a new religion. This city was not God's city in the sense that Jerusalem will later be. This was to be man's city. This was a secular enterprise built by man, and for man's glory. It was a move to be independent from God. They sought a name for themselves apart from God, and they didn't want to share their glory with anyone. Now this phrase about them building this tower with its top in the heavens, or as some translations have it, a tower that reaches to the heaven, indicates it as a place of worship. I mean, they're not just saying they're going to build this really tall building that literally is going to go to the heavens. If that's the case, they would not have built it on a plain. They would have found a mountain where they get a couple of thousand feet head start at least. The notion of it reaching into the heavens or its top in the heavens is a way of indicating it would be a place of worship. The Bible traces all false worship and false religion to Babylon. Here's the beginning of it. False worship is to be expected when people turn from the true and the living God. We know that from Romans 1, 22 and 23. Here's what we know. When people deny God and refuse to worship Him and suppress the truth of God, it's not that they don't believe in anything, it's rather that they believe in everything. It's not that there will be no gods, it's that there will be a multitude of gods, and that's what's happening in this passage. It is the establishment of a religion without God, a religion that is man-centered. It's well documented that the zodiac originated in Babylon, and this is the heart of false worship, that something else, worshiping the creation rather than the creator. What I want you to see is the arrogance of man. God didn't tell them to build a city. They said, let us build a city. And the reasoning was they wanted to receive glory for it. And they wanted to determine their own worship in defiance of God, who alone has the right to tell them how to worship. We don't need God. We'll build our own city. We'll provide our own security. And we'll even supply our own gods. Their arrogance is revealed. And it's an arrogance that's just as present today as it was then. It's the same attitude. You run up against it every day. And on a regular basis, you and I participate in it. When we decide, I don't need to bother God with this one, I can decide this. I don't need to consult His wisdom. I got this one figured out. I know what's best for me. I know what's best for my family. I know what makes more sense. It's the same attitude. It's an attitude that I can determine for myself, which was there in these folks at Babel. It was also present in Adam and Eve in the garden. It's the root of sin. I don't need God. I can decide for myself. The arrogance is revealed. Second, in verse 5 through verse 7, the power of God is demonstrated in response to the arrogance of man. I love verse 5. Note the irony of it. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of man had built. Now what did they say about their city? What were they going to do? We're going to build this thing with a tower that reaches into the heavens. It's going to be a glorious, wonderful thing. It's going to be an impressive thing. And no doubt it was. According to their standards, no doubt this would have been an impressive sight. They built this huge monument for their own glory. And again, I think it was probably a work of art. I think it was probably an engineering marvel. There was probably a lot to commend it. But the point is, whenever God decided He'd look at it, He had to come down. And the language is, He had to stoop. He take the best and brightest that man has to offer, and God has to stoop way down to catch a glimpse of it. It's so far beneath and so insignificant compared to Him and to His glory. Don't miss the irony of it. The height of human ingenuity, lofty and unequaled in its grandeur. But God has to stoop low to see this puny extravagance. It's always that way. Man's greatest intellectual and spiritual achievements are nothing compared to the work of God. One more thing. Let's do this so that we will not be scattered or dispersed throughout the earth. How do I know this is all in defiance to God? What did God tell them in chapter 9 in verse 1? Be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Let's build a city so we don't get moved from this spot. It's clear, open defiance. And the final thing is, I want you to see in verses 8 and 9, the consequence of rebellion. The Lord came down, verse 6, He says, "And the Lord said, Behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do, and nothing that they purpose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language, so that they may not understand one another's speech." So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. The divisions among men are the result of the judgment of God. Man in his arrogance, man in his defiance, said, "We don't need God. We'll do things our own way. We'll build our own city to our own glory. And we'll supply our own gods." And God stooped down, took a look around, and then I think He said, "No, you are confused." And then He stirred the language so they couldn't understand each other. And then He dispersed them. And the significance to me is just the simplicity of the telling of the story. It's not extravagant. It's just simple. Because it was no big thing for God to do it. They thought they were so powerful. I mean, we read about Nimrod, this mighty man. He was the first to be called a mighty man. He established these great cities. Then they come to this point, they're going to build this great monument. And God just says, "I don't think so." And disperses. When the kings and the peoples of the earth plot against the Lord, it's a laughable thing. And why is it important for us to know that? It's important for us to know because we live in a troubled world. We live in a world where men seek power and glory. And powerful and influential people think they can build a utopia. They think they can build monuments for their own glory. That'll be for the good of all people if we'll just bow before them. And what you and I need to understand is that they are nothing in His sight. And if they come to power, they come to power for a time, for His sovereign purpose. That's our only peace, and ultimately that's our only comfort. Are you worried about where we're heading? If you say no, then you're not paying attention. If you take an honest look at our country and where we are and what's likely to unfold, it's a frightening picture. It's not alarmist anymore to say we may be changed fundamentally. The life that we know may be radically altered in a very short period of time. I mean, you just run the numbers. Am I worried about it? Yes and no. Yes, in that I don't like the thought of my life changing drastically. I kind of like it. I kind of like the standard of living that I enjoy. I kind of like the freedom that I know. I don't like the thought of where we're heading, and I don't like the thought of where my children and grandchildren are going to face. But ultimately, am I worried? No. Because ultimately, it doesn't matter what the crowd in Washington does or anywhere else on the face of the earth. God is sovereign over all things. God may take our country through hell in order to make us what He wants us to be. I don't like that. But what I have to rest my head on is that He causes all things to work together for the good of those who love Him and are called according to His purpose. And that's not just true for me as an individual. It's true of the church collectively. So what that means is, even on a national level, whatever God takes this country through is ultimately for our good and His glory. Because He's sovereign. And men can make their plans. But God's will be accomplished. And men can stand in defiance of His will and His way, but they can't stop it. Ultimately, God's will be accomplished in the earth. The purpose of the story in Genesis 11 is to remind us of the absolute folly of man's arrogance, the folly of his defiance of God and His will and His purpose. And in seeing that, understand that our God is in control. And that our best interest is always at heart, in the heart of our Father. And so, regardless of what comes, I rest my faith, my hope, my trust, and my future in Him.
You've been listening to a Plowman podcast. Find us on the web at theplowman.org. The Plowman features the preaching ministry of Rod Harris, pastor of Trinity Baptist Church in Tulsa, Oklahoma, located at the corner of 41st and Union. To learn more about the ministries at Trinity Baptist Church, visit us on the web at www.tbctulsa.org.